In a sleepy little West Texas town where not much happened all year, they were planning for the event of the year, the high school play. And unfortunately, they had miscast the young man who was to play the leading role. And it was an inviolate rule, once you cast the part, you could not change it. At the critical juncture in the play, this young man was to go down to his knees and propose to this lovely girl before him. The window was to go up, the jilted suitor was to fire a gun, and the boy was to leap to his feet and shout, "Good heavens, I'm shot." And that's just about the way he said it. And they coached him, and they drilled him, but the kid had no histrionic ability whatever. He just couldn't identify with the part. Finally, the night of the play came. And as the high school coach was going out the front door, he noticed his son's air rifle in the vestibule, and he got an idea. Now, you let me finish the story. Sure enough, at the critical point, this boy drops to his knees before this young lady. The window goes up. The jilted suitor fires the gun, and the high school coach is standing in the sidelines, and with split-second accuracy and timing, he just nicks this boy's trousers, and the kid stole the show as he leaped to his feet and shouted, "Good heavens, I am shot!" Now, I suspect that this probably expresses your sentiment at this juncture. You've been through IBS. Some of you are in the last half of the 70th week. And I want you to know that I am grateful to God and to you, and I would be most remiss and a betrayer of my heart if I did not convey how grateful I am for the privilege accorded me. I assure you, I have not viewed this series lightly. I have spent a great deal of time making intercessory investment that the Spirit of God would light some fires that will never go out. And if God could give you just one half of what He has given me in my marriage, I assure you it would have been worth all of the time and the investment. Tonight I want to speak on the subject, what is genuine love? Dr. James Peterson, professor of sociology at the University of Southern California, recently concluded a rather extensive study of several thousand married couples in a random sample across America. This was his conclusion. Out of every 100 couples married for at least 20 years, there were only 6 that could be termed happily married. Why? Why is it that the average young couple comes into a marriage with stars in their eyes only to discover before long it's really sand? Why is it that there is so deep-seated disenchantment with one of the greatest privileges God ever gave to a human being? Why is it that thousands of times every day of the week some judge's gavel drops and the words are uttered, "Divorce granted"? I believe although marriage is one of the greatest of human relationships, it is probably the one for which we are least prepared. Worse, there is more negative than positive preparation for marriage in our present culture. 3 of the most determinative decisions that a person ever makes in his life are these. First, he must make a critical decision concerning his master. Who is it that is going to control my life? Who's in charge here? Who will be the sovereign to direct this individual? The second decision he must make is, what is my mission? Why am I here? How can I come to the end of life and guarantee that I will have a sense of fulfillment? That I've not poured my life down a rat hole, but that I've made a significant impact on my generation and culture. And the third most critical decision a person makes is that concerning his mate. With whom am I going to spend the rest of my life? Who's the person not only with whom I can live, but the one I cannot afford to live without? And men and women, never forget, it is the first of these that is the most determinative. For in the final analysis, your choice of your master will determine your choice of your mission and of your mate. Even in evangelical circles today, I am sad to say, it is the last of these three critical decisions for which the average young person is ill prepared. It's easier to get married in our country than it is to become a Mason. If you're going to become a Mason, you have to know something. You have to get the hand clasp. You got to know a few signs. You got to memorize some words. But the countryside is covered with marrying parsons, far more concerned about their rate than their responsibility, who are delighted to provide any kind of a ceremony for a slight fee. No questions asked. Now, there's no question in my mind but that the greatest preparation for marriage, barring none, is the preparation you get in your own home. Earlier in our study, we looked at a very significant triangle. We said that the horizontal relationship between a man and a woman in a married relationship is primarily determined by the vertical relationship which this man and this woman sustain to the Lord. The more dynamic their relationship to the Lord, the more dynamic their relationship to each other. This is the foundation of a Christian marriage. Tonight I would like you to see another dimension in this constellation. Let's suppose, for purposes of illustration, that God gives to this marriage a son and a daughter. We have long known that it is very important for this son to build a strong personal relationship with his father. For it is from his father that he determines what it means to be a man, what it's like to serve as a father, as a husband. And if this man is a beast to this woman, then this man is rearing a first-class pervert. And I want to underscore this fact in your thinking. Perverts are primarily developed in home. This woman must establish a strong relationship with this daughter. And if this woman should have what we commonly refer to as a feminine protest, she hates the fact that she is a woman. The greatest curse in her life is her femaleness. And she constantly communicates that to that daughter, then she may have the dubious privilege of also rearing a first-class pervert. A girl who will have an extremely difficult time trying to relate properly to the opposite sex and particularly to her mate. But I want you to see this and tie it in with what we were discussing last night. Not only is it essential that this son establish a positive, healthy relationship with his father, but he must also establish a positive, healthy, but not a smothering relationship with his mother. This daughter must not only relate positively and healthily to her mother, but she must also relate, though not over-relate, to her father. The greatest perversion on the American scene today is homosexuality, or lesbianism as it is referred to in the female. We are now up to 5 out of 100. In some sections here in Southern California, 24 out of 100. And some very remarkable studies have been done, longitudinal studies which have given us profound insight into this problem. We have discovered there are two primary causes for homosexuality, and I want you to take them down. More importantly, I want you to run them through your mind. The first fact discovered is this. A homosexual invariably comes from a home in which a father is a hostile, detached, passive individual. He's hostile, he's detached, he's passive. He's a zero in terms of leadership in the home. He may be very articulate outside of the home. But in the home, very much out of it. The second fact is this. A homosexual often comes from a home where there is a dominant, aggressive, smothering mother. When you put the two together, you have a lethal combination. If I remember the statistics correctly, in the study, almost 76% of the individuals studied had both a hostile, detached, passive father and a dominant, aggressive, smothering mother. If you will look at these two carefully, you will immediately perceive that these are exactly the opposite of the biblical roles for a husband and for a wife. Unfortunately, apart from Jesus Christ, I have seen very little at the clinical level of real cure in this area. I have seen Jesus Christ wonderfully transform a person's life who was plagued with this problem. In fact, the Apostle Paul said that in the church at Corinth, there were those who had been delivered from this sin, and such were some of you, he said to the church. But I want to say something that ought to encourage you tonight. While we have not been too successful in the area of cure, the greatest contribution comes in the preventive area.
You show me a young person reared in a home with a father and mother incurably in love with each other, incurably in love with Jesus Christ, and communicating that love to the children so that those children not only learn how to receive love, but how to return it. And you will never find a context in which this flourishes. And I believe, young people, that one of the greatest challenges confronting you, who will be leaders in the next generation for the cause of Jesus Christ, is that you think very seriously about how you can prevent this from ever taking place in your home. Now, the most used and yet abused term in the English language today is love. Tonight, I want to take a slightly different tack. Up till now, I have been attempting to lay a firm biblical foundation for your marriage and for your home life. And tonight I would like to share with you some yardsticks, some tests by which to measure your love. I'm not going to spell out all of the scriptural rationale tonight, and that for a reason. I don't want to spoil the fun. I want you to chase through the Word of God and study on your own the fantastic doctrine of love in the Scripture. To me, the process is often more important than the product. And I wouldn't rob you of the privilege and of the profit that will come if you'll take time for this study. Tonight, I'd like to share with you some principles which I trust will provoke, not paralyze, your thinking. And perhaps we can whet your appetite to do some study. Before we look at these, let me take just a moment to give you three objectives that I have in mind. Number one, if you are not married, I would like to give you something that will help you to determine if or when you are in love. The romantic complex in our culture is so deeply entrenched that it's very difficult for you to separate love from infatuation, and they are vastly different. The average young person today thinks that sex and love are completely coterminous, and they are not, either in practice or in the Scripture. We'll see this in a moment. Secondly, if you are married, I would like to suggest some means of measuring the quality of your love life. And I think it is very healthy periodically to take stock and to ask yourself some rather penetrating questions. For it's very easy just to rock along, just to move with the stream, and never stop to ask, where are we going? What are we developing? And then I hope for all of you, if you plan in any way to minister on the college scene in this generation, I want to give you some ammunition with which to counsel with others in this very practical area. Answering the question that many will ask you. Principle number one, true love involves a responsiveness to the total person of the one love. You do not fall in love with a body. You fall in love with a person. In Luke chapter 2 and verse 52, we have a highly instructive summary of the life of Jesus Christ. Here we are told concerning our Savior that he increased in wisdom, that is, in the mental aspect of his life, and in stature or size, that is, the physical aspect of his life, and in favor with God, the spiritual aspect of his life, and in favor with man, the social, the emotional component of his life. A total person involves his mind, it involves his body, it involves his spiritual nature, it involves his psychological makeup, and in particular his relationship to himself and to other people. One of the problems a young person runs into is that he thinks he's in love, and the truth of the matter is he is simply attracted by the physical alone. Please note, I am not saying there is anything wrong with physical attraction. This is a part of human personality, but it is not the whole. Can you think of anything more abominable than to marry an individual who externally may appear very attractive to you, but after the marriage, you discover that mentally they're a dunce. Spiritually, they're a pygmy. Emotionally, they are a cripple. Socially, they are a boor. They hate people, and God has called you to minister to people. In other words, what you are trying to do is to develop a relationship with another person which is attractive to you in every area of human personality. Then as that individual grows old and the physical inevitably loses its attraction, the person becomes infinitely more attractive to you. You know, many times we think that because a person is young, he's therefore really with it. He's alive. And unfortunately, working with seminary students, I've discovered that you can get a guy who's 22 and he's dead in the head and everywhere else. And you could well write over him the epitaph, died age 22, buried age 67. For he really stays around a long time. Though mentally, he is really not very much alive. I have a friend of mine in Dallas that I enjoy going to see. She's 84 years of age. This dear woman is the most alive woman I have ever met in my life. Last time she saw me, she said, "Well, Hendricks, what are the five best books you've read in the last month?" So we were in a conversational group. It was really quite inane, and she deplores that. So she whips around and says, "Well, let's not sit here and bore each other with ourselves. Let's get into a discussion. And if we can't get into a discussion, let's get into an argument." You know, I thought to myself, what a contrast to a lot of young people that I've seen that are already in the process of calcification. You see, hardening of the viewpoint is far more lethal than hardening of the arteries. And what you are trying to do is to find a person who is a growing individual in every area of his life. Here's a second. In true love, there is not only a feeling of pleasure, but also of reverence. I believe in a true love relationship, the feeling of the sacredness of personality in your relationship is a developing experience. What a blow this is to the young man, obviously not under the control of the Spirit of God, who superficially says to some girl, you know, if you really love me, you'll give me everything. Men and women, make no mistake about it. If you ever ask me to do anything that causes me to lose respect for myself, that causes you to lose respect for me, and that causes me to violate the clear-cut teaching of the Word of God, you do not love me. That couldn't be further from the biblical concept of love. That's not love, that's lust. And in a Christian relationship, we are trying to develop an intimacy which builds sacredness and which does not tear down the dignity, the worth, and the God-given stamp upon that person. I've had many occasions to talk in fraternities and other places with young men where I can often get much more directive. You know, over the years, it's been very interesting to me to talk to many a young man and say, what kind of a girl are you looking for? He says, you mean now or permanently? Well, I said, I'm very interested that you would distinguish the two. But let's say permanently. What kind of a girl do you want to marry? Oh, no question about it. I want a pure girl. I want a clean girl. One guy said to me, I want a girl that not everybody in the world has plotted over. I said, that's a good objective. He said, I want you to shoot straight with me. I'm going to ask you one question. How fast and loose have you played with other girls? Well, you know, I mean, I'm not really as much a stud as most of the guys around here. But honestly, I would have to say that I played it pretty loose. I said, in other words, what you are saying to me is that you want a girl that no one else has touched, but you want to spend all of your life ruining other girls for somebody else. You know, that sounds seriously like phoniness to me. That's hypocritical. That's a double standard. One of the things you have yet to experience if you have never married, and God should lead you to marry in the Lord, is the sacredness of the person that God has given to you in trust in your marriage. And you will have the experience that many an individual has described to me of breaking out in cold sweat and sometimes feeling you should fall before this man or this woman, not to worship him or her, but to worship the God that gave that person to you. What a sacred relationship, my friend. That's not to be prostituted. And the greater the intimacy, the greater the sacredness. That's really the great problem with excessive petting. That you are taking something which God has specifically designed as a prelude to intercourse, and you are using it, hoping that somewhere along the route, before it goes too far, you can bail out. And it's just like taking a series of dominoes and hitting it at one end, and it goes clean to the other. I think if God ever grips you with this, young person, you won't be hung up on some little legalistic routine as to what you can do or cannot do. But you will come to the realization, if this is God's girl or God's man for me, then friend, I'm not going to shoot myself out of the saddle with immediate gratification in order to mortgage what God wants me to reserve and enjoy in the marriage relationship which is to come. Here's a third one, and this will wipe you out. True love always has a quality of self-giving. Your purpose is not to exploit a person, but to enrich them. God so loved the world that he gave. And I think two young people who are in love always give me the distinct impression that they want to devote their entire lives to each other. They want to fuse this relationship into a marriage, into a team where they can work together. And the strengths and the assets of both can be forged into a focus for God. You see, there are many people who are really not in love at all. They are simply in love with themselves. And any person totally wrapped up in himself constitutes the smallest package. It is not until you come to the place where you understand it is more blessed to give than to receive that you've gotten to the ground level of what true New Testament love is. You see, this individual thinks much more of the happiness of the other than himself. His total satisfaction comes in pleasing him. I had a woman come to me some time ago, tremendously hung up in her marriage. I said, well, what's the problem? Well, for example, you know, he doesn't like what I wear. Well, I said, what does he like? Well, for example, he likes yellow dresses. I said, lady, do you mean to tell me that you're in love with this man? Oh, yeah, I think so. I said, look, if you're in love with him, my friend, you would develop an incurable love for yellow. I'd wear yellow till it was coming out my ear. But the longer we investigated, the more we discovered she was really in love with herself. And when you don't like yellow, then that's what you project. I've been working with a little kid who has a stuttering problem. Many a kid reared in a home, he comes through a period of time when he gets a little hung up with his speech. So happens this boy's father is a PhD and his mother has two master's degrees. His older brother has an IQ of 153, and he's something of a dunce. He only has 148. And in the process of developing, he stuttered. And this shook his parents up no end. What a blow to have a PhD and have two master's degrees and have a child that stutters. So what they proceeded to do was to start to make fun of him. Every time he would stutter to them, they would stutter back to him. You know what they have managed to do? They have managed to drive that so far in this kid's life that as far as I can determine from speech pathologists, four of them that I have consulted with, this is a hopeless case. I was taking him home one day, and I said to his mother, would you mind if I bought them some ice cream? Well, she didn't like it, but I guess she couldn't bail out, so she stopped. I went in with this little fellow and his sister, and I said to the young lady, honey, what kind would you like? She said, I'd like strawberry. I said, give my gal a double strawberry. I turned to my friend, I said, hey, buddy, what kind would you like? He said, chocolate. Great. Double dip of chocolate for my pal. So I was paying for the ice cream. And when I came back to the car, I found chocolate ice cream on the concrete. And I looked at the guy and I said, what happened, buddy? Did you drop it? We'll go get another one.
And then I took a glimpse of Mom. "Madam, what kind of ice cream would you like him to have?" Would you believe? She doesn't like chocolate. So no child of hers is ever going to eat chocolate. You say, "How perfectly juvenile, my friend." I will show you this every single day in thousands of marriages across this country. You see, when you are truly in love, young person, you are so enraptured with the person, what are they like? That's exactly what the psalmist was talking about when he said, "Delight thyself in the Lord, and he shall give thee the desires of thine heart." That was the first verse I ever memorized, and I never understood it. You mean to tell me that if I delight myself in the Lord, he'll give me the desires of my heart? The young lady that I eventually married, I courted in the city of Philadelphia. She lived in southwest Philadelphia, and I lived in northeast Philadelphia. I used to have to take a trolley car, a subway train, a bus, and another trolley car. It took me an hour and a half to get from my home to her home. And I can still remember flying out the front door with my grandmother after me saying, "Howard, you didn't do the dishes." I said, "I'm awfully sorry, Grandma, I don't have time. I've got to go over to see my girl. I'm in a hurry." And I take the trolley car and the subway and the bus and the trolley car and go all the way across town to do what? The dishes. And you know, to this day, nobody can convince me that doing dishes in the presence of that delightful woman is drudgery. I have no greater joy. Then I began to discover what the Lord was trying to teach me. Delight yourself in the Lord. You see, my problem, my hang-up, any self-centered individual's hang-up, is that you're wrapped up with your little two-bit desires instead of enamored with his delight. And when you continue to get yourself occupied with him, then his word becomes your word. His will becomes your will. His way becomes your way. And through the most wonderful of spiritual metamorphoses, you come to love him. And you become like him. A fourth, true love embraces a willingness to take responsibility as well as to take the privileges. You see, with many an individual, a marriage is a cop-out. Certainly they want the pleasure. Certainly they want the privileges. Certainly they want the conveniences. Certainly they want all of the advantages, but when it comes to the responsibility, then they tend to flake off. And I think you can test whether you are really in love by the pressure that occurs in that courtship. And don't cry out to God the next time it happens saying, "What happened?" Because it may be God graciously at work putting that relationship to the test so that you are convinced you are related to a person who not only wants privileges, but who is capable of taking responsibility. And when the pressure gets on, and when the bullets are real, and when life is sliced as rough as it is in fact, then you will be thankful that you are married to a man, that you are married to a woman, a person who is mature and who isn't always looking for the fire escape every time the pressure comes on. Fifth, true love is marked by unusual joy in the company of the other and pain in separation. unusual joy in the company of the other, and pain in separation. True love attracts like a magnet, and it never wearies. You see, many a young person tips his hand in effect. He tells me that he is not in love with this individual. He is merely infatuated with him or her. They haven't been together for 2 weeks. But they haven't done anything else except be together for 2 weeks. And at the end of 2 weeks, they're already out of gas. And he's fed up with her. And she'll scream if he talks to him. And what has happened is that they have developed such a superficial kind of relationship. They were attracted only on the basis of the physical or some other element in isolation, with the result that the mature factors of love have never really had an opportunity to develop, if they're present at all. And I say to a person, if you can be away for long periods of time without feeling any longing to go home, to go back, then I would highly question the relationship. And by the way, young people, again, thank God that He will bring into your relationship periodically periods of separation. Because often periods of separation are periods of perspective, where you determine if you can get along without them. If it's nice but not necessary. The ministry to which God has called me, I think it is perfectly obvious to you that I have been compelled to be away much more than either my wife or I would choose. We do not do this by choice. We do this by the calling of God on our life, to which both of us are convinced. And you know, it's a wonderful thing to be away and yet to know that your heart is really at home. People say to me, "What have you learned about sacrifice?" I tell it to you like it is. I really haven't learned very much at all. But the greatest sacrifice of my ministry has been that I have been compelled to be away from the one that I love more than life itself. But that has only been possible because we're both convinced that we're called to the same mission. And I assure you, Thursday morning at 8 o'clock when that plane takes off, if they have a hard time getting off the ground, friend, I'll give them all the gas they need to take off. And I'll be home Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday before I have to catch a plane to come back to Arrowhead Springs. But man, it will be a ball. Sex. True love is characterized by the mutual enjoyment of each other without need for constant physical expression. There is a mutual enjoyment of each other without need of constant physical expression. My friend, if you can't be together as a couple without petting, then you do not have the adequate resources for marriage. Marriage is not one constant petting scene. It's not legalized prostitution. It's not an orgy that goes on morning, noon, and night. A wonderful relationship in which the physical is simply a part of a larger whole. And the physical derives all of its meaning as an expression of love that grows out of the totality of the relationship not simply one phase of the relationship. It's kind of pitiful to see. I can almost call it. Whenever you see a couple crawling over each other's frame, almost looking like they're coterminous, one person, cannot stay away from each other, almost look like a monstrosity, you mark it well. Take a good look in 6 months to find out what's left. It is a plain fact, statistically shown in hundreds of studies, that promiscuity before marriage is the greatest potential for promiscuity after marriage. And purity before marriage is the greatest prevention against impurity in the marriage. When I find a young person whose only means of communicating his love is in the form of some physical expression, I know they really don't have adequate resources. They haven't put down shafts in their love life that are deep enough to stand the pressure of married life. I see so often two young people so close, so physically involved, and man, 3 weeks after the marriage, they're sitting in my office and they won't even talk to each other and they won't even sit on the same side. You know, my friends, after you see this, as much as I am compelled to see it, you begin to realize there must be a better way. I'm not suggesting that there is not physical expression before or after marriage. I'm saying if that's all you got, you really don't have enough. 7. True love has a protective attitude, a desire to shield the other one from any harm. It has the greatest interest of the one loved in view. And again, I see a habit, and unfortunately, it even develops in excellent Christian organizations like this. It's a habit that, from my point of view, if you'd break yourself of it right now, you'd never have any regrets. And that is what I call the sarcastic routine. It's just that little barb in the relationship. You know, he comes home from the office and he says, "Well, what's the burnt offering for tonight?" And we've got company over, and she arrives with the upside down cake, upside down. And he cries out, "Well, here comes Betty Crocker." And you know, young people, what this does? This is like pouring sulfuric acid on your arm. You take a drop and just drop it on your arm, and in time, another drop, and if you continue doing it long enough, you'll eat the arm away. That's what happens in a marriage. I think one of the most practical things you can ever learn is to ask God for grace, not to tear down your partner, but to build him up. Does this destroy or does this edify the relationship? And there's an awful lot that does nothing but shred it. And you can't really afford that kind of a relationship. How different to see a man who's the number one cheering fan of his wife, and to find a woman sold out to her husband and doesn't mind grabbing him by the coat lapels and pulling him close and say, "Sweetheart, I am indescribably proud of you, and my greatest claim to fame
is that I have the privilege of being your wife. You know, I was talking last night about what your children overhear. Many years ago, I was sharing with my wife how great was my privilege, and I thought my kids were asleep. And my oldest son was listening to everything I said. He deliberately stayed awake until I went into the other room. He came out in the room and he threw his arms around me and he said, "Dad, thanks. Thanks a lot for loving Mom like you do." You see, my friends, these very small things, what Solomon refers to as the little foxes that spoil the vine, the little considerations that are communicated out of the overflow of a life that is controlled by the Spirit, these become the most communicated. An eighth test. True love possesses a feeling of belongingness. You have the sense developing that you belong to each other, that this is your personal property. And you identify yourself with the other so much so that you want to share whatever comes into your life with this individual. This is why, to me, communication is so important. And this is why I say to a person on the staff of Crusade or involved in any way in the Lord's work, my friend, be sure to share with your family and with your wife particularly what God is doing in your life. Now, there's a negative here. One of the things you will learn is that when you get into a position of Christian leadership, you learn too much. You know too much. I know too much about all kinds of situations and people and things. And it's very easy to come home from the seminary and drop all of that garbage on my family and poison them en route. I have developed what I call my point of no return. On R.L. Thornton Freeway coming out from the seminary, there's a little creek called White Rock Creek, and that's where I drop it all. And as I'm coming by, I just deposit the whole mess right on the side of the freeway. Just drop the whole ball of wax, all of the problems of the seminary and the counseling and the rest of it, so that when I get home, I don't infect my children. I've seen so many Christian workers do this, and with the result, the kid develops a bitterness, a critical attitude, a desire to do anything except get involved in the Lord's work. You know what happens when I come back Monday or the next day and drive along that highway? You know where those problems are? Exactly where I left them. Not really. They cross over the freeway. They wave at me. Then I pick them up and take them in. Ninth, I wanted to say, let me add it as an addendum, no less important, I assure you. It's a terrific thing to come home and share with your wife and your children, all of whom have been praying for you, supporting you, making your ministry possible, to tell them what God has been doing freshly in your life and ministry, and which they share it. That's a positive type of thing I'm talking about. Many times I have come home, and I think this is the primary reason, at least my two sons tell me, that the primary reason why they are concerned and interested and involved in the process of coming to the seminary is that I have come home so many times to share with them what God is doing in the life of my students, the exciting things He's teaching me through them. And the result is, instead of this becoming some monster that we don't have anything to do with,
It becomes the thing that becomes attractive to them because it's the symbol of what God has been doing through the ministry of their father. Ninth, true love has a feeling that you understand each other unusually well. Because what happens is you begin to feel the same way about important things. There is a fusing of minds. The communication lines are always open. And you feel here is a person with whom you can share your most heretical idea, and the person won't cross you off. There is a mutuality of response. You love the same thing. And you care about how the other person feels. There's no indifference here. The last one I'd like to leave with you is this. True love, as it matures, is not only dynamic in its growth, it's Christ-like in its characteristics. And I want to leave you with an assignment. It'll be the most exacting assignment you have had in IBS, for it will do far more than stretch your mind. It will stretch your heart. I want you to study 1 Corinthians 13 and concentrate on verses 4 through 7. And every time the apostle uses the term love, you insert the term Christ. Christ suffers long and is kind. Christ does not envy. Christ does not vaunt himself. He is not puffed up. And after you have seen that true love is Christ-likeness, one of the greatest summaries of the life of Christ ever written, then the next part of the assignment is this. I want you to put your name in. Hendrix suffers long and blows his cork. And if you are married, I think one of the greatest exercises would be for you and your wife to sit down and read that section. And after inserting Jesus Christ in place of love, then read first the husband and secondly the wife's name and ask, how much do I know of the reality of this in my experience? Young people, marriage is not a process of finding the right person. It is a matter of becoming the right person. There are many of you who have spoken to me during this time I have been here and said, I'm looking to God to direct me to the man or the woman of his choice. My young person, friend, don't ever rush it. Don't panic. If God has a man or a woman for your life, he's perfectly capable of leading you to him. He's not losing any sleep tonight. He's not biting his nails, wondering if you'll ever find them. I think what he's really concerned about is, do you have your focus in the right place? Is it on becoming the right person, like Jesus Christ?